You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
You can't padlock an idea. Miles Horton famously said this to the local sheriff when the state of Tennessee shut down the social justice center that Miles co-founded, the Highlander Folk School. Their symbol is a rocking chair, and over the course of 80 years, the Highlander has brought people together, often in rocking chairs, to learn and strategize for social justice. The Highlander played a crucial role in the region's civil rights movement and the labor movement. After being relocated, sometimes forcefully on several occasions, the center is still thriving and playing a central role in building movements for social justice. It's now called the Highlander Center for Research and Education. Red Eye's Peter Driftmeyer toured the Highlander, and he spoke about the center's role in history with staff member Matthew Griffin. Here's Peter speaking with Matthew Griffin.
There's the symbol of the rocking chair is on the logo, and when you took me inside of one of the meeting spaces, rocking chairs were a big part of it, rocking chairs in a circle. Why is the rocking chair such a big part of what makes the Highlander the Highlander?
So, you know, part of it is that the rocking chairs are in a circle because we want people to be able to interact with each other on an even playing field. Sort of popular education, which is the term that we've come to use for Highlander's primary methodology, in which people come together and share their experiences, and everyone is a teacher and a student at the same time. And so by having the rocking chairs in a circle, we try to help foster an environment where that's conducive to that. And then, you know, the rocking chairs themselves, one of the things, you know, in the early history of Highlander, they were working with people from the mountains, and those people weren't particularly talkative. You know, when you brought them together, they didn't automatically just want to sit around and talk about their feelings and talk about their experiences. And so one of the things Miles Horton talked about as being a challenge in those early days was figuring out how to get those people to be comfortable and how to get them to share. And so I don't know if the rocking chairs were developed at that particular time, but I think they serve a similar function in getting people to feel comfortable in the space, which then leads to them being more open.
That's so cool. Like if we were to transplant the Highlander to Vancouver, Canada, there wouldn't be that same medium, you know, to just tap into. It's not like just put a bunch of people in front of rocking chairs and they'll automatically feel comfortable. So how would you describe the like social and economic backdrop that the Highlander Center's in?
Well, you know, right now, especially, I think, after the last few weeks, or really the last few months, with the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act and the verdict in the Trayvon Martin case coming down, you know, I think we're at a point where a lot of sort of like different sectors of grassroots organizing are starting to like bubble up. Right, because there's just so much happening particularly in like the southern states, where really conservative legislatures have sort of taken over. In North Carolina, for the first time since Reconstruction, conservatives are in charge of both houses of the legislature and the governor's office, and so they are passing through really, really draconian legislation. And, you know, we're seeing the Voting Rights Act gutted, affirmative action gutted, you know, black men being killed in the streets with no repercussions. And I think in some way, people see that all those things are related. And so what's happening, I think, is that in North Carolina, well, at the same time as we're seeing these sort of draconian laws being passed, we're also seeing the resistance to it. You know, organizing. They're holding the Moral Mondays every Monday at the legislature, where people are sitting in and being arrested. And that's being led partially by William Barber, who's the head of the NAACP there. He was here at Highlander a few weeks ago as part of a strategy session in the South. And all of that was sort of happening before all these other issues, right? And that resistance had begun before all these other sort of issues across the country were bubbling up, and now the folks who have been organizing the Moral Mondays are also taking part in some of these other actions that we're seeing across the country. And so I think a lot of the sort of focus right now is in those areas. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, I think it's also tied, I think that is really, it's tied to the sort of economic background. The same people who are passing the laws in, for instance, North Carolina. North Carolina is sort of on my mind because it's so close, because it's where I'm from, and also because it's sort of where people are, I think, being really startled by the extremity of some of this legislation. They repealed the Racial Justice Act in North Carolina, which gave black people essentially recourse to ensure that their verdicts in court hadn't been motivated by racial bias. That's been repealed at the same time that, unemployment has been totally devastated and public education has totally been devastated. And so much of the economic inequality that's being forced on us further than it already was, of course, also it seems to be tied in to a lot of sort of racial undertones as well.
What did this region look like socially and economically back in the 30s that gave rise to the Highlander Center?
Yeah, so in the 30s, people were dealing with a lot of poverty. This was an area that it was economically devastated even then, in a way. There was a lot of mining going on. There was a lot of logging going on. And so people were starting even then to sort of see the effects of that on the landscape around them, on their health. And then at the same time, of course, they were also not being paid livable wages. And so there was a sort of confluence, I think, of economic factors and environmental factors, where people were really suffering, and that's sort of what the idea for Highlander came out of.
Like, the Highlander is famous, like, I've heard of it in Canada, and it's famous around the world. What would be some of the proudest achievements of folks here at the Highlander?
I think people are really proud of the citizenship schools where Highlander worked with people out of South Carolina to develop a program that taught black people to read and write, both so that they could learn to register, they could pass the literacy test that was required to vote, and then that the way they did that was also sort of rooted in looking at a larger framework of social justice. One of the things that they learned to read was the International Declaration of Human Rights. And the way that program sort of spread throughout the South, I think, is something that people at Highlander are really proud of. The song We Shall Overcome, of course, I think is a something that everyone here is proud of. It has a long history of association with Highlander. Zilphia Horton sort of helped some people who brought it to her rewrite it a little bit, and then from there Pete Seeger learned it, and then Guy Carawan learned it, and then he taught it to a lot of the leaders of the civil rights movement, and so that's another thing that people here are really proud of. And, of course, the fact that Rosa Parks was here a few months before refusing to give up her seat on the bus is also another piece of history that I think everyone's really proud of.
Cool. And so it started by a couple folks in the labor movement coming together and seeing the need for a space like this. Is that correct?
Well, so when Miles Horton and Don West co-founded it, they weren't actually in the labor movement yet at that time. They had just both been here and had seen the struggles that people here were having, and they'd seen the really terrible conditions that people were living in and wanted to sort of help them figure out a way to solve their problems. And they didn't know when they first started if that was just going to be like bringing people together to learn how to like fix a well or something like that. They didn't know, I think, at the time when they started it, the exact shape it was going to take. But sort of through listening to the people and hearing about their experiences, they realized that one of the major problems and one of the major factors that was keeping those people in poverty was the economic system that they were trapped in. And so I think that's really what led them into the labor movement.
Okay. Because this region has also been the site of very intense, like, coal miner labor struggles.
Yeah.
Has that been kind of their main way into the labor movement, was through the kind of mining sector, or was it more because there's also a big farming community here?
You know, I think it was partially through mining. I know they did some stuff with logging. And then from there, they also became involved with sort of all kinds of industry throughout, the region. And textile workers, I remember Sylvia Horton telling a story about leading some textile workers in song while they were striking. But I do think sort of the mining industry was the way they originally sort of entered into the movement.
And so for... if you were to pitch the Highlander as a resource for social justice movements in the United States, what would they be able to get in terms of support here?
Yeah. Highlander's real strength is that it brings people together to learn from each other. Because we do believe that the people who are most affected by the issue are the ones who should be leading to solve it. And so there's a process to bringing people together and to helping them get the most out of their time with each other. And I think that's something that Highlander staff is really skilled at. Highlander also works really intentionally to bring people together across issues and across divides to work together. So, I think in the same way that Miles Horton and Don West realized that the labor movement could never be strong enough to succeed if it was racially divided, we see now that sort of the larger progressive movement is never going to be strong enough to make real lasting change if it's divided, right? If people who are working for environmental justice are being pitted against workers who are concerned about keeping their jobs. And if, values, quote-unquote values, are being pitted against equality for all people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another thing that I think Highlander can contribute to the movement. We also work with particular methodologies. Cultural organizing is a methodology that's really important here at Highlander. And that's essentially building on the legacy of people like Sylvia Horton, who sort of really infused song and music and art into Highlander's work, as well as people like Guy Carawan, who eventually taught the song We Shall Overcome to a lot of civil rights figures. And so in that realm, we focus on teaching both artists and particular groups working on particular campaigns to use art and song and culture to fortify those campaigns and strengthen them. Another thing Highlander has contributed and continues to contribute is participatory action research, which essentially says that the power of information should, again, be in the hands of people who need it and can use it and shouldn't be sort of closed off to quote-unquote experts. And so there are several examples of this in Highlander's history. We helped with the Appalachian Land Study that essentially documented who owned the land in the Appalachian region and ultimately found that the vast majority of it was owned by corporations that weren't even located in the region. And then another example of participatory action research was Highlander's work with Bumpus Cove, where they helped a group of people from a community that was having toxic waste dumped in the vicinity, both research the materials that were being deposited there, and then also access the hazardous waste records, essentially, to prove that they were, in fact, toxic to them. And so Highlander continues, I think, to be a resource for people who are just looking for information as well.
Mm-hmm. There's obviously kind of centers that are loosely comparable to the Highlander around North America, and some of them have their own campaigns, their own organizational strategy.
Mm-hmm.
and their own politics that they put forward in a very explicit way. Does the Highlander do its own campaigns as well, or is it just focused on supporting other movements?
You know, primarily we focus on supporting other movements. Highlander definitely has its own organizational values and its own, what we're at this point calling key points of leverage, which are essentially, you know, areas of work that are being done in the region that we see as being as having the greatest potential for lasting change. And so those are places that we are intentionally focusing our resources. And we do also sometimes lead our own campaigns. In particular, what I'm thinking of is we sort of spearheaded this movement, and it's towards something that now we started calling language justice, but what it was about making sure that when people were coming together, that everyone was able to communicate in the language that they are most comfortable with. And so to that end, we developed a translation curriculum. We did trainings with translators. We purchased some translation equipment, and sort of worked very intentionally to infuse progressive gatherings that were happening at the time with that capability. And so that was something that we really took the lead on. And so there are instances where Highlander will sort of pick up a campaign, but you know, in general, we see our role as listening to the community, right? Because if we truly believe that the people who are affected by an issue should be the ones leading it, then it's up to us to listen to them and see what is affecting them and what they want to work on, and sort of instead of sort of sitting back and deciding for ourselves what we think is most important. You know, now of course in that process that there still are certain values we're acting out of, and there is, you know, a certain level of our own analysis that's going on of the work in the region and what seems to be working and what doesn't in terms of where we put our resources.
Has the analysis or the political orientation within the broader progressive orientation, has that shifted over time at the Highlander?
You know, I think it tends to just shift in focus, right? We've always sort of been dedicated to having a society that is just for all people, but sort of the way we go about that has shifted from originally being focused on the labor movement to the civil rights movement, then to sort of the Appalachian region and environmental justice, and then to immigrants' rights, and then starting to see things in more of a sort of global perspective and realizing how much of the injustice we see in our society is tied at this point to a particular, right, to sort of global capitalism and things like that. And so I think sort of the particular focus and how we approach the problems shifts over time, but sort of the core values stay the same.
Yeah. And so you have a garden, you have a library, you have meeting spaces and spaces where people can stay during retreats.
Yeah, that's correct. And then in here is the library itself. You know, I think the library now doesn't get maybe as much use as it did before now that we have the internet, people don't necessarily need to come to a library to find this kind of information. But for a long time, Highlander was a place that, you know, people thought of as having the library and having the information where they could come to find out about whatever problems they were dealing with. I like this bookshelf over here a lot. These are the books from personal collections of Highlander's founding members. When I first started here, actually, the first day I was here, someone had found a copy of a book of children's nursery rhymes that Mae Justice had written. And Mae Justice she lived beside Highlander in its original location in Monteagle. And she was just a good friend of Highlander when a lot of people during those days weren't. And so it was actually a book that of nursery rhymes that she had written, and she had given it to Miles Horton, and there was an inscription in the front that said, you know, to Miles, yada, yada, yada. And someone had just found that at a yard sale, and so they brought it and gave it to us, and I thought that was pretty cool.
That's incredible that they found that copy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So what did that look like, the antagonism from neighbors?
You know, I mean, in those early days, they sort of encountered a lot of hostility. There were times, you know, when they were shot at, fires happened. But I think also, you know, the sort of antagonism then, you know, people call them communists and things like that. And then the antagonism sort of magnified to becoming not just from sort of the people around them who were sort of suspicious of them, but from the state itself. Once they started working, particularly in the civil rights movement, the state of Tennessee and even surrounding states, I think like the governor of Arkansas had a vendetta against Highlander. And so then all of that took the form of the trial after, so the state, I guess it was actually the county, right? The county raided Highlander, found that someone there had been drinking some alcohol, and then charged them with distributing liquor without a license. And so then there was sort of the long trial. They also charged Miles Horton with profiting from Highlander. And so there was sort of a long drawn out hearing and trial. At one point, the district attorney or the prosecutor had like a chalkboard where he was trying to link like every radical or communist person in America, like back to Highlander and Miles Horton. There's like a nice bubble chart that he's drawn up. And so then that led to the state revoking the charter and seizing the property, for which Highlander has never been compensated. And so that was when they moved to Knoxville and then a few years later to here.
And this would have been at the time also of the civil rights movement, and they were, and all these states surrounding the main Appalachian states were segregated.
Yeah. So this would have been like 1961, I think, was when the raid was, and then the trial happened, I think, in 1962. Right. And so those were all sort of the early days, or not the early days, but right, sort of the heart of the civil rights movement. You know, the March on Washington was 1963, so it was all in that same period of time when, and in the South, right, where it was, everything was still very segregated. Yeah, I can actually show you, there's a cool poster around here. There's Rosa Parks at one of the integration workshops. I like this poster. So this is when actually the sheriff was putting the padlock on Highlander after the raid, and Miles Horton famously said to him, "You can't padlock an idea."
And that was Matthew Griffin, as a staff member of the Highlander Center for Research and Education. He was speaking with Peter Driftmeyer of Red Eye. Over the past 80 years, the Highlander has supported civil rights, labor, and other social justice movements. It's located in Newmarket, Tennessee. For more information on the Highlander and its Generations to Come capital campaign, you can visit highlandercenter.org.